ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் .org, தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். த டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் சூஸ் ரியலிஸ்டிக் கோல்ஸ், பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
Well, we had an interesting experience last night. Palani Swami and I went to the dinner at the Marriott, which was honoring Mayor Marianne Kusaka's eight-year legacy. And the mayor was very happy to see us, very happy that we took the time to go to the event. She realizes we're not socially inclined, so appreciates our social efforts. And Palani Swami gave her a beautiful gift of eight bunches, each containing three dwarf tea plants, right? Get that right? So eight bunches, eight symbolized her 8 years of service. I don't know if the three symbolized anything, but okay. Here we go. So 24 plants all together, and it turns out the mayor loves dwarf tea plants, and she only had five so far, so now she has 29. She said, oh, well, after I'm out of office, you must come over and look at my garden and see how beautiful it is. So it's a perfect gift for her. She was really happy to get our dwarf tea plants. So it went along. We had to leave a little early. We left at 8 so we could get back at a reasonable time to get up at 4. So we didn't get to stay till the end. But the surprising part, you know, it was, in theory, this is a time of acknowledging Mayor Kusaka. But a lot of people came up and acknowledged us. You know, that was the surprising part, that for the different things we had done. One of them being helping the mayor accomplish a very important part of her legacy, which was spreading the message of aloha around the island. And this person felt that the monastery's role in that was crucial, that it wouldn't have happened in near such a all-pervasive manner, shall we say, on a larger scale as it did, without our helping in producing and distributing the aloha posters and the aloha cards. So that was very nice to hear that we were so integral to the success of that program. And also we got acknowledgement just for being up here as a monastery of men thinking about God, doing spiritual things. And we got some acknowledgement for that, that people on the island would come up and be totally uplifted and forget about all their problems and so forth. And acknowledgement that Gurudeva is guiding their spiritual lives. That was surprised us. You know, we have Nani from Hawaii Community Foundation popped out the statement, Gurudeva is guiding my spiritual life. You know, we didn't expect that. You know, she's very supportive and all this and that and appreciates being up here. But for her to have that perspective that Gurudeva is guiding her spiritual life just really surprised us. So we went away with a sense of how many people on the island really appreciate the monastery for its spiritual contribution to the island. It's very nice in that sense. So the other miscellany before I get to the talk is that today is Ayuda Puja, tool blessing ceremony. Silpis bless their tools, so those of you who can stay, we're going to walk out at around 7:30 and have to give them time to set up. That's why we can't go out earlier. They've been working. The two of them came in, two seniors came in. What time? Was it around 6, I think? To They always come in first to the temple and then go out to the work site. So they've been working since 6:10, setting up the work site for the puja. So we have to give them time. So it's a traditional ceremony that's part of Navaratri in India. And if you've ever been there, if you've ever been there, then you wouldn't be surprised how all-pervasive it is. But if you haven't, it's amazing how many things get blessed. Taxi cabs, for example, have banana trees tied on each side and three stripes. Chandanam, kumkum, all over them. And elevators are also blessed. Each elevator has the same markings on it, which stays there for about a week before it wears off. So whatever tools you're using, whatever mechanical objects you're using, get blessed on this one day a year. And it's a, you know, it's a very interesting thought that we can ponder. You know, what is the significance? Something like this, you'd never find it in the West, where there's one day a year when the secular objects are blessed. Somehow it doesn't happen. So one of the, would you say, one of the down-to-earth aspects of it is the clearing of negative forces. Negative forces can build up around an object, thought forms, or even asuric kinds of influence in some places can occur, and blessing, you know, in the same spirit as a house blessing, clears out these forces. So, you know, once a year, taking time to bless everything helps get rid of any negative forces that have accumulated for one reason or another around these objects, which can cause accidents. So there's a practical side. You know, if you're working with tools, like Tandu, you have all your tools, you know, you can bless them once a year on Ayuda Puja Day to get rid of any negative forces and that may have accumulated. And it's the same idea. Cleanliness is just an extension of that. In our Savai Chastras, there's a number of references to how the presence of dirt accumulates negative force. So, negative thought force. So, therefore, it's very important to keep like a house clean. So, it's a good practice. You know, if things seem to be getting off track, you know, maybe take the weekend off and clean the house. You know, maybe we've let it accumulate dirt and debris, and we need to clear it out of these forces. So that's the practical side. And the spiritual side, it helps unite the inner and the outer. Helps us look at what we do in the outer world as a religious action. Again, the Western idea is that what we do in the outer world, oh, that's just secular. It has nothing to do with religion. Religion is somehow separate from our everyday actions. So when we take the time to bless the tools we use in our everyday actions, it's helping us change that perspective to the idea that our everyday actions should be an extension of our religious beliefs and goals, and not separate from that. So it helps unite the inner and the outer. So, for example, a businessman who separates his business from his religion doesn't have that deeper perspective. It's better to unite the two so that they're not distinct. Religion permeates his business, his domestic life, going to the temple, you know, permeates everything he does. There's no part of his life that's not permeated with religious beliefs and goals. We don't separate life into separate parts. hearts. One more area which is very frustrating, something I'm sure we've all experienced, days when everything goes wrong. If there's anyone here who hasn't experienced a day when everything seems to go wrong, raise your hand. Okay, this is a common experience, right? Sometimes it's called getting up on the wrong side of the tatami mat. Whatever, wrong side of the futon. Wrong side of the bed. Just from when you get up in the morning onward, everything seems to go wrong. You know, it's just, oh, one of those days. Maybe it's ashtami. Even ashtami has too bad a rep. Ashtami is problematic, mostly, at least in the monastery, for communications between people. Everything is like there's static in the air. It's like your reception isn't good. Somebody says something and you hear something else or you misunderstand it. Communications between people tend to get complicated, misunderstood, and hard feelings arise and so forth. It's not a good day for teaching, for example, holding classes. That's why in the traditional Hindu study system, you don't go to school on Ashtami. So anyway, these kinds of days do happen. And when the day is over, instead of taking the 2 steps forward that you thought you were going to take, you've taken 1 step backwards. You know, things went so poorly, it would have been better if you hadn't done anything. You know, it's like the data got erased. Now you have to spend tomorrow recreating it. You know, whereas if you hadn't done it, you still have your data. But what you did, erase the data, and therefore you have to spend one whole extra day just to catch up to where you were before you started that day. So it's definitely an excuse to feel, you know, I'm frustrated and discontent because not enough is getting accomplished, right? It's another reason for feeling frustrated. Not enough got accomplished. So this can be very discouraging if we get ourselves into that state of mind. The basic problem is we're refusing to recognize that days like this happen now and then. They just happen. And we can't prevent them from happening. It's like we don't complain when everything goes super well and we get twice as much done as we expect, right? Somehow that's okay. You know, we can get twice as much done and everything can go better than ever expected. But if the opposite happens, it's like bad karma. You know, it's not supposed to. So having a realistic expectation that things like that happen is the first key to not getting totally frustrated by it. A nice approach, if you're able in the midst of something like that, is to step back. Sometimes our tendency is the opposite. You know what? We're like the charging ram or the goat, you know, butting our head against something. We want to push forward at all costs. Things get even worse and we push forward with more willpower. Somehow this exertion of willpower is going to solve our problem. If we only just keep trying and trying and trying, everything will work and we'll figure it out and so forth. But that can be very externalizing. Pushing like that. You know, we get ourselves out into external consciousness if we're not careful. So the opposite can be more helpful if we're in a situation where we can do it, is to step back and step away from it. Go do something else. You know, take a short walk. You know, eat lunch early. You know, something to step back from it and avoid this tendency to just push and push and externalize ourselves. And then come back to it. You may come back to it in a more intuitive flow. Things may work better. Just because you step back, you've internalized your awareness enough so that you're approaching it from a different state of mind. And sometimes, if there's a problem you can't solve, you just sit down and the solution is immediately in your mind from your sub-superconscious. You let the external tension go enough to go inside. And the inner comes out and you sit down and you say, oh, I see. And you immediately solve something that you couldn't solve for hours and hours just by stepping back from it. So that's a very helpful approach that Gurudeva teaches emerging with Shiva for bringing through the sub-superconscious mind. Because we need to relax and let the tension go. Another approach to this kind of situation, particularly if others are involved, it's a group effort, is to see if there's some knowledge lacking. Maybe we don't know enough about this computer program, or somebody doesn't know enough about it. Maybe we don't understand a certain piece of machinery, or one of the people on the team doesn't understand enough about this piece of equipment, so therefore we haven't used it in an efficient way because we're lacking in knowledge. So quite often that can be what's causing everything to go wrong. Either we or someone else doesn't understand something. So of course, when in the sense of everything going wrong, we usually don't think about things like that. But if we can step back and ask that question, does somebody lack understanding? Do they need training in something? What kind of training is needed here? Do we need to pull out a book? Do we need an instructor to come in? Do I need to teach somebody something? You know, to step back in the midst of that kind of frustration and ask that question, and if you come up with an answer and then implement it, yes, we need training in this, this, and this. Person isn't trained, or I'm not trained, and go through that training, we can prevent this all from happening again. So it's a very good approach to working through a situation of frustration. So those are just a few thoughts. This is a topic under development. It's like a website that says under construction. So that's all I have for this morning. Met with some devotees last phase, and something about being on the path, you know, what someone experiences, everyone else does too. It's part of the spiritual journey. Is that it's not unique. Everyone goes through the same steps, the same stages, the same experiences. So this one, which, of course, we've all encountered before, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, a very sincere devotee, a woman who was asking about the spiritual path and spiritual life and spiritual striving, and certainly was sincere in wanting to have deeper spiritual experiences, which was all really, really, really wonderful to see. But she also had a sad attitude. And she was sad because her spiritual experiences weren't deeper than they were. There she was on the path, practicing very sincerely every day, and having this concept in mind that all the great spiritual experiences that are there toward the end of the path that I'm not having them, so I'm sad. So she was creating a sad journey for herself. I mean, that's a pretty long journey from where she was to, you know, this end of the path paradise, you know, blissfulness, all pervasiveness, so forth, that she wanted to experience more of right now. So made me think about that. Of course, it's not Gurudeva's attitude. He says life is meant to be lived joyously. He doesn't say we should be sad until we experience Parashiva or until we're all pervasive or something. No, he doesn't say that. He says life is meant to be lived joyously, meaning when we're on the spiritual path, we should enjoy it. We shouldn't create concepts that make us unhappy because of what we're not experiencing. Why do that? You know, that's an understanding of the spiritual path which is flawed. We want to look at it so we not only enjoy the end of the path, but we enjoy getting there. You know, we want to have fun on this journey. Enjoyable journey. Laugh, smile, enjoy ourselves, and, you know, not just hold our breath and cry and feel unsatisfied till we finally get to the end of it. That's a long time away. So one example of that is meditation. You know, the monks meditate every morning. And I don't know if any monks look at it this way, but of course, we're all trying to realize Parashiva, and it's an important part of our discipline. But we could have the attitude, I'm meditating, I'm going to realize Parashiva, and if we come out after the meditation and we haven't realized Parashiva, we could be sad, right? We could be frustrated and say, oh, I didn't realize Parashiva again. This is terrible. Another day without Parashiva. Life is barely worth living. You know, we could create that attitude by how we look at it without even giving much thought to it. We frustrate ourselves. We don't enjoy the journey along the path. So, for example, I explained this to one of the monks. You can set it up so that you have more than one goal in meditation. Create some easy ones and some harder ones and some very hard ones. And so, for example, easiest goal is Sinchung BC, feeling the spiritual energy of the spine. That's easy to do. You know, anyone can do that, but it's also worthwhile just really going into that spiritual energy and becoming centered and content and so forth. Is something any of the monks can do in any meditation. So do that first. Get the satisfaction of that. Get the success of that. And say, okay, this is great. I feel wonderful. I'm fulfilled. I'm not frustrated. I'm fulfilled. I experience Simshun Bisi. Now let's see if we can go deeper. Let's try for the inner light. Let's try and go into the intense inner light, Ifche, which we do in our morning meditations. So maybe we won't get there, or maybe we'll get there on some days and not others. Because if the mind is a little bit disturbed, we don't see the inner light. The mind has to be calm in order to see it. If we get there, fine. If we don't, that's fine too. We at least got to some Shumbisi. This was a worthwhile meditation. And then we try and go deeper yet. We try and experience Parashiva. Well, that might not happen that often, necessarily. But we try for it anyway. If it does, great. If it doesn't, we're still happy. You know, we set ourselves up so that we feel fulfilled, not frustrated, by the meditation we experienced. Just because we didn't experience Parashiva, we're not heartbroken and crushed and sad the rest of the day. You know, that sounds silly. You know, you can laugh at it, but still you can set yourself up that way if you're not careful and fail in meditation, fall short, and therefore feel frustrated and lacking. Whereas meditation should never make you feel that way. It should always make you feel fuller, more fulfilled, more content than you were before you started, not less content. So then we flew back to Malaysia. And had a book signing at the Kandaswami Murugan Temple. No, I can't say that. Kandaswami Temple. And the Ceylon Saivite Association of Selangor, who some 20 years ago had hosted the famous two schools of Saivisiddhanta conference. But these days we're on best of terms. The president was extremely respectful, Mr. Parambalam. The youth of the temple and our own youth worked hard to coordinate the event. So definitely there's no... Gurudev, on his last visit, went to the temple there too. So definitely times have changed. We're on the same side, which is nice. So that, you probably saw the pictures. That was the world's largest garlands that happened there, you know, buried in garlands. I left them on because I was in a chair with a back on it, so I could, otherwise they're like, I don't know, huge weight of garlands. But they were so beautiful, I didn't want to take them off down to the ground, you know, just the long ones. So that was the talk on the Nalapada Saivam, the four stages of discipline in Saivasiddhanta that you've also heard, drawing heavily from Dancing with Shiva. sold lots of books, including 23 Living with Shiva, which was very good. It's a very expensive book in Malaysia. And the talk was well received. We had a nice meeting with the youth group. And in Malaysia, youth is anyone under 30, roughly something like that. A different concept of youth than in the U.S. In the U.S., youth is anyone under 20. But the youth group, who is coming together in a dynamic way, and I've recently, as you know, had a number of, I've had two Master Course seminars, and had the family retreat, and had the honoring of mothers and fathers on Father Day and Mother Day. Done a lot of activities recently. They met and planning out an Irivan Day for January, and lots of other wonderful activities. And very organized group, very dynamic, and the Kulapati are happy to step back a bit and let the younger group create activities and for them to approve them and help supervise them. So it's coming together with new energy, and which is nice to see. Then in Singapore, we pulled out our nine qualities again and gave a talk at the Hindu Center, which I think is about, filled up the room, which is about 200 people, I think. And it was just in English, and so got the ideas out. Our old friend Roger Durai was there. Many of you know him, elder in the community. Comes to everything. And it's the first time I've given a talk in Singapore. Usually I've just spoken to the members, so this was a first for me, reaching out more to the beyond our own small group there in a nice way. So just to one last thought here on the one of these nine qualities, perceptive self-correction. The ability to quickly draw the lesson from each experience and resolve how not to repeat one's mistakes. This quality is developed by teaching that mistakes are not bad. They are opportunities to learn and refine our behavior. Gurudeva calls them wonderful, and then Living with Shiva says wonderful opportunities to learn mistakes. So I, on a number of occasions, I took a poll. I said, now, how many of you, if you were raised to look at mistakes as wonderful opportunities to learn, please raise your hand. No. I think I got two hands out of, hundreds of people. So it's not a common perspective. Somehow, the usual teaching is mistakes are bad. You're supposed to be smart enough not to make mistakes. Somehow you're just supposed to know so many things and never make a mistake. And if you make a mistake, it reflects badly on the family and so forth, and it's terrible. It's not being realistic here. The process of mistakes, as Gurudeva points out, so wisely, from the up-down point of view, they're wonderful opportunities to learn. That's how we improve, is through making mistakes. So I told another story. I said, now, imagine this situation. We have the mother is at home with the young child. The child makes a huge mistake. And this is like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So what's the mother do? Mother calls up the father at work and says, dear, I have wonderful news for you. Our young boy made this horrendous mistake. And, we have a wonderful opportunity to teach a very good lesson here so he doesn't do it again. So I wanted to call you up so that on your way home from work, you could start thinking about it. By the time you got here, you could figure out what lesson it is you need to teach the boy so he doesn't do this again. Isn't this wonderful? trying to get a new perspective on it. Because Gurudeva definitely had that perspective, that mistakes are wonderful opportunities to learn. And it's, related to positive discipline. It's the same subject, but looking at it from the teaching point of view, and that there's an obligation in any situation, a parent-child situation, to teach and to learn. When mistakes occur, it's the duty of the parents to teach something and the duty of the child to try and learn so the child doesn't repeat the mistake again. But definitely it's the whole negativity surrounding mistakes makes this process difficult. You know, we need to kind of sweep that all away and take a fresh look at mistakes. And mistakes, oh, how wonderful. Made a mistake. I have a chance to teach something. That's how progress occurs, right? If we never make a mistake, we're never progressing. We make mistakes because we're trying to do new things that we haven't done before. We're growing up. We don't know certain things. You know, mistakes are a natural part of human development. So the whole idea about making them good is the first idea. You know, just erasing the sense of negativity about mistakes. And it applies in any teaching situation. Parents to children, senior monks to junior monks, Dalavar to members of the Kulam, teacher, school teacher to children, supervisor to employees, you know, all kinds of situations have this process involved in it. And so in each case, the senior one should expect mistakes. And then when they do occur, not put out the sense that something's wrong or bad or negative, but try and figure out what it is the person needs to learn to not repeat the mistake. Quite often with parents and children, the parents are assuming the child knows something that he doesn't fully understand. They've taught it either not at all, or they've taught it incompletely, or they rushed through the lesson, and the child doesn't really understand something that they think he does before the mistake occurred. So, you know, to having enough patience to ferret out what it is, what understanding is missing, is an important part of it. And then when all of that is taking place, then you get the quality we want, which is perceptive self-correction, meaning when someone's an adult, they've developed the habit of correcting their own mistakes because of how they were raised. They make a mistake, they don't get depressed. They think about it. What did I do wrong? How can I do it differently the next time and not have the same problem occur? It's just a way of thinking about life. And certainly Gurudeva had that quality, perceptive self-correction. So that is what we want to have when children reach young adulthood, perceptive self-correction.